licked his cheek. God, how she worried about him. He was healthy, despite having been a preemie. Her pediatrician, Dr. Patel, reassured her of this again and again. In their bedroom, Jason was waiting for her. He wanted sex all the time, even after so many years of marriage. Tonight would have been a good night to indulge him with a serious creative effort, but sex seemed too tame for Claire's mood. Her meeting with Locke Dixon had gotten her gears turning. She wanted to pore over her back issues of glass art. She wanted to go into the hot shop, museum-quality piece, and sketch until dawn. "Come to bed," Jason said. Thinking about the hot shop suddenly felt illicit. "How are the kids?" "Fine, come to bed." "Don't you want to know how my meeting was?" "How was your meeting?"
"It was amazing," she said.
He didn't ask her to elaborate, and Claire thought, why bother? Her definition of amazing was completely different from Jason's definition of amazing. Jason was a contractor. Amazing for him was the plumber showing up on time. It was a 39-inch striper caught with a fly. "Come to bed, please, Claire. Please, baby." "Okay," she said. She brushed her teeth, then took her time washing her face and moisturizing, then wiping down the granite vanity and the bowl of the sink, hoping that Jason would fall asleep. But when she crawled into bed, Jason had his light on. He was facing her side of the bed with his hands out, like she was a basketball he was about to catch. "The kids didn't wear you out?" she asked.
"Nah, they were great."
"You read to them?"
"I read to Zach. Oddly read to Shay. JD did his homework, then read his chapter book."
"Good," Claire said, relaxing. "So, the meeting." She paused, not because she was hesitant to admit that it had only been her and Locke at the meeting, but because Jason's hands were already traveling up inside her camisole. He wasn't interested in what had transpired at her meeting. Claire grabbed Jason's wrists, but he was persistent, and she let him go. Their sex life was robust, but there was a part of their marriage that had withered, if it had ever existed at all. What was it? They didn't talk. If Claire said these words now to Jason, "We don't talk," he would tell her she was being silly. He would say, "We talk all the time." Yes, about the kids, about what was for dinner, about the car being serviced, about Joe's 40th birthday next week, about what bills need to be paid, about when he'd be home from work. But if Claire tried to explain her meeting with Locke and its many tangents, Matthew, how it felt to think about Matthew, how it felt to think about Daphne and the accident, Locke's interest in Claire's glass, and his request that she come out of retirement on behalf of the auction item, Jason would glaze over, bored. She would be keeping him from what was really important, the sex. Furthermore, he might grow angry at what Claire told him. Who was Locke Dixon to tell his wife to start blowing glass again? It was easier for Claire to keep her mouth shut, to indulge Jason physically and try to quiet the agitation in her mind. Find Matthew. Museum quality piece. Silver belt buckle. The jungle series. Whalebone corsets. Viognier that tasted like a meadow. $50,000. Classical music. She really should learn more about it. She closed her eyes and kissed her husband. Chapter 2. He haunts her. The Crispin children started waking up at 6:30. They awoke in reverse order to their age. Zach first, then Shay. At 4 and a half, Shay was very challenging. JD and Ottilie had always been labeled the big kids, which left Shay and Zach as the babies. But Shay did not appreciate being called a baby,
nor did she like being lumped in with Zack. As a result, she was constantly trying to distinguish herself. Everything had to be done the Shay way. Her pancakes had to be cut with a chef's knife because she liked square pieces. Otherwise, the pieces would be called ugly and were therefore inedible. She would not sit next to Audley at any meal, and she would not have her hair styled like Audley's, nor would she wear any of Audley's hand-me-downs. Audley, for her part, was preternaturally beautiful, with long hair streaked the colors of fine wood, mahogany, heart pine, Brazilian cherry. She was, at the age of 8, already a teenager, already using her ballet training to swing her hips provocatively. Audley was precocious, brilliant, adept at sweet-talking her parents, her teachers, her legions of friends. And J.D., Claire's oldest, was a golden child, reading 3 grades above level, a leader on the ball field and the basketball court, an altar boy at St. Mary's. He was pleasant and easygoing and respectful. If Claire received compliments about her parenting, it was because she had great kids. But they were great on their own. They had been born great. Claire didn't want to take any credit. She did, however, try hard as a mother. She would say she'd always tried hard, had always put her children's needs before her own. But now that there was no glass in her life, she channeled all her frenetic, creative energy into parenting. Her kids were only going to be young once. She wanted to enjoy them. She now had time to pack healthy lunches, to volunteer in all 3 classrooms, to chaperone field trips, to read Harry Potter aloud at night, to make every practice, every ball game, and every ballet lesson early or on time. She was more focused. Her house was cleaner. Her kids, she thought, were happier now that they had her full attention. Her parenting wasn't perfect, but it was earnest and well-intentioned. Just look at Claire this morning. She made breakfast for 4 kids. Bacon, buttermilk pancakes, chocolate milk, vitamin pills. She chose clothes for 4 kids. The only one she could truly dress anymore was Zack. With the other 3, the struggle was what matched, what was appropriate for school, what was clean. She packed lunch for 3 kids. JD liked strawberries. Audley demanded an obscene amount of mayonnaise on her sandwich. And Shay was allergic to strawberries. The only fruit she would eat without a fight was canned mandarin oranges. Claire kept track of homework, library books, permission slips, and whatever equipment, cleats, gloves, skates, goggles, they needed for their after-school activities. There was a color-coded schedule taped to the fridge. It wasn't always the well-oiled machine that Claire dreamed of. Often there were extenuating circumstances. Someone had a stomach ache or a luridly loose tooth. It was pouring rain or blizzarding sideways, or Zack had one of his inexplicable screaming fits and the noise pushed them all to the edge of insanity. Mom, make him stop! Many times, Claire stood in her own kitchen and thought, I can't believe I make it through the morning, much less the rest of the day. Many times, Claire felt like a triage nurse. What needed her attention first? This was the life she had chosen. She repeated certain thoughts like a mantra. Good mother, only young once. Enjoy them, as she shepherded them out the door. Claire drove the kids to school. She took 2 to the elementary school and 1 to Montessori. Zack was strapped into his car seat, crying for his bottle, which none of the other 3 deigned to give him. Shay plugged her ears. The car was always loud, but Claire made a point to call Siobhan anyway. Siobhan had stopped at 2 kids, but Liam and Aiden were total hellions and fought incessantly, and Siobhan's car was just as noisy. I woke up this morning and checked my calendar, Siobhan said. I see I missed your meeting last night. How was it? Oh, Claire said. The meeting had been a scant 12 hours earlier, and yet it had slipped down the drain with the dishwater. Her excitement had vaporized, but something lingered. Some feelings about Locke Dixon. Could she share these feelings with Siobhan? She and Siobhan were married to brothers. They were frank with each other about their marriages. They loved to complain. Sneaking cigarettes, too much TV, always bugging me for sex. And they loved to one-up each other when they complained. Because Siobhan and Carter worked together, she claimed they were twice as sick of each other at the end of the day. Siobhan had a crush on the Korean UPS man. Claire thought the 20-year-old who picked up her trash was cute. They talked about other men in a funny, harmless way all the time. But Claire decided not to say anything about Locke, if only because she couldn't tell what her feelings were exactly. It was fine. We talked about preliminary stuff. Do you have a co-chair? Siobhan asked. I do, a woman named Isabel French.
Isabel French?
Yeah, do you know her?
Siobhan was quiet.
This was very strange. Claire checked her phone, thinking it had cut out. Are you there? Claire said.
Yup.
Is everything okay?
We did a luncheon for Isabel French this summer, Siobhan said.
You did? Where does she live?
Out in Monomoy. But not on the harbor, in the woods. On Brewster Road. Between Monomoy and Shimo, really.
Okay, so what's the deal? Did she not pay her bill? Was she a total bitch?
No, she was fine.
With me.
Was she rude to Alec?
Alec was Siobhan and Carter's Jamaican head server.
Did she use a racial slur?
No, Siobhan said. She was fine, agreeable. Very nice.
There was just this awful moment when she was out on the porch chatting away, and a coven of witches were in the kitchen slicing her to ribbons. I guess there was an incident in New York. She was at some big party and she drank too much, and she kissed some woman's husband on the dance floor, and it turned into this big thing where no one would speak to her, and she stopped getting invited to things. She used to sit on the board of one of the big hospitals, but I guess they asked her to step down. It didn't sound too good.
They were talking about her behind her back in her kitchen, Claire said.
Yeah.
It made me nauseated, honestly. Did they know you were there listening?
I'm the caterer. Did they care?
So, do you think it's bad that she's my co-chair?
No, I don't think it's bad, Siobhan said. Just so you know, her own people don't like her.
Claire and Zach walked back into the house at 8:10, and the silence was like a big sigh of relief. Pan sat at the counter eating a bowl of Cocoa Puffs, a cereal forbidden to the children.
Why does Pan get to eat it?
Well, Pan is an adult. Pan was 27 years old, from an island off the southwest coast of Thailand, in the Andaman Sea. Pan had arrived after Zach was born to work as an au pair, although Claire liked to think of it as a cultural exchange. With Zach's difficult birth, and with the demands of a fourth child, having an extra set of hands in the house seemed wise. Having Pan around allowed Claire to be a better mother. Pan played creative games with the older children. She cleaned and straightened. She prepared mouth-watering Thai food. But she was the best, perhaps, with Zach. In Thailand, apparently, babies were never put down. They were constantly carried, and therefore, they did not cry. When Zach was with Pan, he was held and carried. When Zach was with Claire, and Claire out of necessity set him down, "I have to get dinner ready, sweetie," he howled. Sometimes it was so bad that Pan came out of her room and picked him up, and although Claire was then relieved, she was also suspicious. Maybe Zach's problem was that he was coddled, spoiled, soft. Maybe all of Pan's nurturing had quelled Zach's natural desire to explore, to learn, to interact. Or maybe Pan held him all the time because she too sensed there was something wrong.
"Here," Pan said. "I take."
She stood up from her stool and reached for Zach.
"You finish, I've got him."
"I take," Pan said.
Zack was no fool. He lunged for her.
Okay, Claire said.
And then, like an automaton,
I have 100 things to do.
Such as the breakfast dishes, plates sticky with syrup, cups with chocolate sludge coating the bottom, and then the counters and the stools. Then Claire went upstairs. The kids nominally made their beds, but Claire had to remake them. She was put out by the thought of her children climbing into a sloppy bed. She liked crisp, clean sheets and a neatly folded comforter. She flushed the toilet in the kids' bathroom, put all of the toothbrushes into the plastic cup, and rinsed the dried toothpaste out of the sink. But what she realized was that she was watching herself do these things rather than just doing them. She was doing them, and at the same time, wondering what Locke Dixon would think if he were watching her. Or Matthew. God, she had to find Matthew. She got started on the laundry. If she missed a day of laundry, it spiraled out of control. Did any of these details matter to anybody but Claire? The details that ruled her life, the 5,000 tasks that cropped up in her day like obstacles in a video game. If Claire died or got sick or took on a consuming project such as the summer gala, and these tasks didn't get done, what would happen? Would the house get run into the ground? Would her children become derelicts? In her heart, she believed the answer was yes. Her efforts mattered. She threw a load of darks into the machine. At 10 o'clock, she tried to do some yoga on the floor of her bedroom. She unrolled a mat and positioned herself in downward dog. The room was filled with sunlight, and being in downward dog felt good. She wondered again about Locke Dixon. If he could see her this second, would he be impressed by her flexibility? No, even Claire's 92-year-old grandmother could do downward dog. She was too lazy to get herself into another position, and honestly, it had been so long since she'd made it to yoga that she'd forgotten all the positions anyway. If she tried one now, it would be incorrect and offer no real benefit. She sat up. Her head was buzzing. She hadn't eaten anything. She had forgotten herself. And that was the reason Claire was so thin. It had nothing to do with yoga. The phone rang. Would it be Locke? One thing about co-chairing the summer gala was that the phone would ring and it would be Locke, or Isabel French, or Matthew. Instead of Jeremy Tate Friedman, her client from London, telling her he'd had a dream about an orchestra that played instruments made of glass, would Claire, for the right price, consider making a glass flute, one that actually worked? Her career had been subject to, indeed dependent on, the eccentricities of a handful of very wealthy people. Claire checked the caller ID. It was Siobhan. But Claire didn't pick up the phone. She had too much on her mind. It was still Locke. Okay, this was pitiful. The man was following her around her own house like a ghost who had unfinished business with the living. Why? What did he want? He wanted her to create a museum-quality piece of glass for the auction. He wanted her to burst out of retirement like a woman jumping out of a cake in front of 1,000 paying guests. Break the shackles of motherhood, emerge from the cave where she had been shutting herself away like a hermit. She had been out of the hot shop for months, and just admit it, Claire. She missed it. A part of her yearned for it. People like Jeremy Tate Friedman called, and Elsa, the woman who owned the shop, Transom, called. Would Claire produce another jungle series? The vases had sold so quickly. But these people did not provide the right impetus for Claire to return to the hot shop. Locke, somehow, had pushed a different button. He had used the element of surprise. He read glass art. He knew not only her piece at the Whitney, but her piece at the Yankee Ingenuity Museum in Shelburne, Vermont, as well. He appreciated her work, and hence he appreciated her, Claire, in a way that few other people did. Who would have guessed? Locke Dixon was a fan. He had always made her nervous. Claire thought this was because of Daphne and the accident. But maybe not. Claire wondered if Locke Dixon had ever seen the inside of a hot shop. If he was willing to pay $50,000 for a piece of glass, then he must know something about the craft. Maybe he had been to Simon Pierce. There were two studios now where you could watch the guys blow out a few goblets, then go upstairs to a fancy restaurant and eat a warm goat cheese salad with candied pecans. Or maybe Locke had seen glass blown in Colonial Williamsburg, or Sturbridge Village, or on a school trip to Corning. She would ask him the next time they were alone. Would they ever be alone again? Why did she care? Did she find Locke Dixon attractive? Well, he was 20 pounds overweight and balding on top, so no, he wasn't Derek Jeter or Brad Pitt. And he wasn't a 20-year-old hunk like the kid who worked for Santos Rubbish. He wasn't as handsome as Jason, who had a washboard stomach and a thick head of blonde hair. But Locke had nice eyes. And that smile. There had been something between them last night in the office. A connection. An energy that had not been present during lunch at the yacht club or at the handful of board meetings that Claire had attended. A spark. Something that caught fire and smoldered. Claire's interest. Her desire. But why? This was the kind of question Siobhan loved. Why this person and not that person? Why now and not before? Why did love, lust, romance, even the real deep and true stuff you felt for your husband, always mellow, and then in some cases sour? And if the mellowing was inevitable, did that mean you simply gave up that tingling, stomach-swooping, giddy, got-him-in-love-or-lust feeling forever? Were you left with your hopeless crush on George Clooney or the UPS man? Siobhan could talk about this stuff for hours as she filled Philo with lobster meat and fresh corn. But until today, these questions had never interested Claire. Until today, she couldn't have cared less. Claire's hot shop was locked up like Fort Knox. When she worked, the furnace ran night and day, and so the term hot shop was something of an understatement. Jason called it the belly of hell. Jason had built the hot shop for Claire because there was no glass studio on the island. He'd started out reluctantly. One expensive hobby, he called it. They spent tens of thousands of dollars on the pot furnace, the glory hole, the punties, the benches, the molds, the shaping tools, the colored frit, the annealer. A small fortune. Eventually, however, Jason became fascinated with the construction of the hot shop. He was building the only glass-blowing studio on the island for his wife, who was trained in the craft. She had a degree from RISD. She could make things, vases and goblets and sculpture, and sell them. Now the hot shop had paid for itself, and Claire had made enough money from the whims of her kooky patrons to pay off the car and plump the kids' college funds. She could not believe she was doing this. She glanced back at the house, stealthily, feeling like a criminal as she unlocked the heavy metal door. But why? There was nothing wrong with blowing glass again. Pan would take care of Zach, and the other kids were at school all day, so why not? But there was guilt. It had to do with her fall. Claire should never have subjected herself to the heat when she was so far along in her pregnancy. She should have been drinking more water. The doctor had warned her, and it was Zach who had paid the price. There's something wrong with him. Still, she stepped inside. She was an alcoholic opening the liquor cabinet. She was a junkie visiting her dealer. But that was ridiculous. She had, after all, come into the hot shop plenty of times in the past year to get tools, to go over her books with the accountants, to show Pan the pieces she'd made as a beginner. But Claire had never come in with the intention of starting up again. When she turned off the heat, she did so in the name of her family. She had 4 kids, a husband, and a home that needed her. Claire stood in the center of the shop and looked around. Just admit it. She was dying to get back in there. Claire's attraction to molten glass was atavistic. It was coded somewhere on her DNA. She was drawn to the flame, to the unsafe temperatures, to the blinding light. A blob of molten glass on the end of a blowpipe contained her life's meaning, even though it was hot and dangerous. She had burned herself and cut herself too many times to remember. She had scars with stories she'd forgotten. But she loved working with glass the way she loved her children, unconditionally, and despite the real possibility of failure. Molten glass fell to the floor. She marvered incorrectly and came out with something lopsided. She blew a piece too thin. She necked incorrectly and could not transfer the piece to the punty. She cooled a piece too quickly and it shattered in the annealer. There was nothing about glass that was forgiving. It was a craft, but also a science. It took precision, concentration, practice. She found a half-empty sketchbook on her work table. Museum-quality piece? The piece at the Whitney was a sculpture of thinly blown-out spheres, so thinly blown that they had to be placed in a soundproof room, all of which held hints of prismatic color and interlocked like soap bubbles. The sculpture was called Bubbles 3. Bubbles 1 and 2 were housed in the private galleries of Chick and Caroline Clausen, and Chick Clausen sat on the board of the Whitney. The Yankee Ingenuity Museum displayed a set of nesting vases with differently shaped openings. When you looked down into the vases, it was like looking into a kaleidoscope. Claire had done the vases in sea colors, turquoise, cobalt, jade, celadon. Claire and Jason and the kids had traveled to Vermont to see the vases on display. The vases were lovely and well displayed in the small, rustic museum, though they didn't compare to the bubbles at the Whitney. Claire couldn't do another in the bubbles series for the auction. That would be like Leonardo repainting the Mona Lisa. But Claire could possibly create another set of nesting vases. Would they be worth $50,000? The door opened, and the room filled with breeze. Claire turned. Pan stood in the doorway. Claire felt like she'd been caught.
"Where's Zach?" Claire said.
"He's asleep," Pan said.
"I'm thinking about working again," Claire said. Pan nodded. She was still very brown from the summer. She wore a black tank top and khaki capri pants and a thin silver chain with a tiny bell on it around her neck. Claire had paid twice already to have this chain repaired after Zach had yanked it off. Claire suggested Pan not wear the chain while she was working, but Pan ignored this advice, and that was fine. The chain and the bell were part of Pan's persona, part of her magic. Pan was short and lithe, and her glossy black hair was cut into a rounded page boy. She was both adorable and androgynous. With the silver chain and the tiny tinkling bell, she reminded Claire of a wood sprite. "What do you think?" Claire asked. Pan tilted her head. "About me working?" Pan shrugged. Possibly she didn't understand the question, and certainly she didn't understand what Claire's working again would entail. Claire shook her head. "Never mind," she said. Pan left, but Claire lingered for another few moments on the bench, paging through her sketchbook. Once upon a time, she had made an elaborate pair of candlesticks for Mr. Fred Bulrush of San Francisco. The pulled taffy candlesticks. She had come upon the design by accident, holding on to the gather with tweezers while rolling the blowpipe. She had twisted and pulled the molten glass, then rolled it into blue and purple frit
that she'd scattered on the marvering table. She was like a kid with clay, and she thought she'd end up with a kid's mess, but the colors blended beautifully, and the form cooled a bit, and Claire recognized it as a candlestick stem. She added a foot and blew out a small bowl, and when it came out of the annealer, she thought, this is really cool. It looked to Claire like a psychedelic popsicle. It was Jason who thought it looked like pulled taffy. He liked it as much as Claire did, but then he said, what are you going to do with one candlestick? And Claire thought, right, I'll never in a million years be able to make another one. She tried again and got close. The color wasn't quite identical, and the twistiness was off, but that was what made it art. She took a picture of the candlesticks and sent it to Mr. Fred Bulrush, a mysteriously wealthy man, a former associate of Timothy Leary's, who loved Claire's work because he believed it contained what he called the elation and pain of her soul. Bulrush paid $2,500 for the pair. What about turning the idea upside down? Upside down candlesticks. A chandelier. Claire had always wanted to do a chandelier. What about a pulled taffy chandelier that would cascade from the ceiling like party streamers, each strand ending in a light bulb the size of a grape? God, it would be utterly fantastic. Would Locke like that? 2 o'clock came, and Claire picked up J.D. and Ottilie at the elementary school, then Shay at Montessori. J.D. and Ottilie had Little League at 3, and Shay had soccer at 3:30. Claire had snacks and drinks for everybody. J.D. and Ottilie's mitts, hats, and uniform shirts, Shay's cleats and shin guards. The kids piled into the car with their lunch boxes, their backpacks, and assorted art projects. J.D. had a flyer for an open house, which wafted like an autumn leaf into the front seat. How was school? Claire asked. J.D. ripped open a bag of Fritos. Nobody answered. Claire checked the rearview mirror. Shay was struggling with her seatbelt. What did you do today? Claire said. J.D.?
Nothing, J.D. said.
Nothing,
Ottilie said. Shay?
I can't get my seatbelt buckled.
J.D., will you help her, please?
J.D. huffed.
Of course, he said.
Claire smiled. She was not Julie Andrews. These were not the Von Trapp children. These were children who had apparently done nothing during a whole day of school. But everything was okay. She had gone into the hot shop, but the fact of the matter was, she liked her life the way it was now. She was consumed with making sure the kids had what they needed. Because she had spent so much time mooning over her sketchbook, she had forgotten to put the laundry in the dryer, and she hadn't done anything about dinner, so things would be insane when she got home. And there would be Zach to deal with because Pan was off at 5. Claire didn't have time to create a museum-quality piece. And yet, the feeling remained. The tug. The pulled taffy chandelier was the most exciting idea she'd had in a long time. Claire turned into the parking lot of the town recreational fields. The rec fields were the site of the summer gala. They were the only place big enough to accommodate the tent and a concert for 1,000 people. Claire wondered if there was any reason she would see Locke Dixon at the rec fields, and decided the answer was no. The soccer fields were a great place to get a glimpse of Nantucket's children. On Shay's team alone, the kids spoke 5 languages. There were 2 Haitian girls, a Bulgarian boy, a pair of Lithuanian twins whose parents were deaf. They spoke English, Lithuanian, and Lithuanian Sign Language. The diversity was amazing. It was exciting. The soccer program was well organized and impeccably administered. It was funded by Nantucket's children. When Claire saw her own group of friends, Delaney Kitt, Amy Trimble, Julie Jackson, she felt the way men must feel about their fellow soldiers. We're all in the foxhole together, fighting the same war. Raising young children, enjoying them, because they would only be young once. Claire walked up to Julie Jackson. Julie was a natural beauty.
She had curly blonde hair and was even thinner than Claire, kickboxing. Julie Jackson had three kids. She sold stationery and occasionally hosted an at-home show, and she served on the board of the ice rink. When Claire saw her, she thought, committee.
Hey, Claire said. Hey, Julie said. How are you? Did you bring the baby? God, I haven't seen him in forever. He must be getting so big.
Yeah, Claire said. Her good mood was like a balloon that she accidentally let go, floating away up over the trees, out of sight.
Claire didn't bring Zach to the soccer field on purpose. She didn't want the other mothers to see him and sense something wrong, and then confer with one another about whether it was because he'd been so premature.
He's home with Pan.
So what's new? Julie asked.
Oh, not much, Claire said.
How to broach the subject? She should send an email, she decided. But that was cowardly, and this was the perfect place to ask. They were overlooking a veritable United Nations on the 6-and-under soccer team.
I agreed to co-chair the summer gala, the benefit for Nantucket's children.
Hey, you know, I would love to have you serve on the committee. Would you consider it?
Julie Jackson had her eyes glued on her son, Eddie, who had the ball. Julie didn't answer Claire, and Claire debated whether to repeat herself. Claire suddenly felt like she'd asked Julie Jackson to join her on the chain gang.
Do you know what I'm talking about? Claire said. The summer gala. It's held right here in August.
I know, Julie said. Locke Dixon's thing. Was he the one who asked you?
Yes, Claire said.
She found herself flustered at the mention of Locke's name. Julie had been in the cab the night of Daphne's accident. Was she making a connection?
They want me to get Max West.
Oh, right, Julie said. I forgot you knew him.
Did she say this ironically, or was Claire just too sensitive?
Yeah, Claire said.
I can't take on one more thing, Julie said. I just can't.
Right, Claire said. I understand.
Me either, Delaney Kitt said.
Me either, Amy Trimble said. Ted would kill me.
It always seems harmless to join this committee or that committee, but it ends up being hundreds of hours and thousands of dollars.
Yeah, Julie said. She grinned at Claire. But it's great that you're doing it, Claire. You're a good egg, making time in your life for this.
Such a good egg, Delaney echoed.
It's going to be so much work, Amy said.
Better you than me.
Claire was late getting home from the rec fields because there was an injured bird on the side of the road. She saw it there, the sparrow or wren, hit by a car maybe, or nipped by someone's dog, injured, struggling but not dead. The kids were limp and exhausted in the back seat. They didn't see the bird, and Claire thought, keep going. She only had 5 minutes to get home in time to relieve Pan. But no, she couldn't ignore it. When she pulled over and said, look at that poor little bird, the kids perked up a little, but they did not get out of the car. Claire knelt by the bird. Something was wrong with its leg and its wing. It hopped lopsidedly. Claire heard a car horn. Amy Trimble slowed down.
What are you doing?
Injured birdie patrol, Claire said.
Amy shook her head, smiled, drove off. Claire reached out to pick up the bird, but the bird was having none of it. It hopped out of her reach, and Claire hurried down the sandy border of the road, chasing it. Julie Jackson drove by. Claire stood up and looked at the back of Julie's car.
Claire was the only person she knew who would stop for a bird.
She was the only person she knew who would agree to co-chair something as colossal and consuming as the gala. But instead of making her feel virtuous, she felt like a bloody fool.
You're a good egg, making time in your life for this.
She didn't have time. Get back in the car. But she could not in good conscience leave the lame little bird here. She sneaked up on the bird and got a hand under it. The kids were cheering her on now from the car. This was all the little bird needed. It got aloft, flew away. Claire was relieved. She headed back to the car. The kids were clapping. A few days later, Claire and Siobhan went on one of their rare girls' nights out, just the two of them, eating cheeseburgers and frites and drinking wine at Le Langue d'Oc. There was a Viognier on the wine list, and Claire's mind flickered to Locke and how she had wanted more than anything during that meeting to please him. She ordered the wine, but she did not bring up the topic of Locke Dixon with Siobhan, because if she had, Siobhan would have teased her. Siobhan had something of the schoolyard bully in her. She taunted, she poked, she prodded. She was always making outlandish suggestions and daring Claire to join her. It was commonly understood that Siobhan was naughty and Claire was nice. Claire was sweet and Siobhan was spicy. Siobhan carried the pitchfork. Claire wore the halo. Siobhan cursed like a sailor and danced on tabletops. Claire carried spiders outside instead of smushing them in a paper towel like a normal person. Siobhan was the one people wanted to be stuck with on a deserted island. Claire was the choice if the plane was going down and there was only one parachute. She would hand it right over.
"Let's go to the chicken box," Siobhan said now. "Find a couple of hot guys and go dancing."
"No way," Claire said. Siobhan frowned. Her darling square glasses slipped down her nose.
"You're no fun," she said, inhaling her wine. "Why couldn't I have gotten a sister-in-law who was fun? You're a boring bore."
Yes, Claire felt like a boring bore. But she also felt virtuous, and doubly so because she knew Siobhan wouldn't go looking for trouble on her own. And she was correct. They paid their bill. They went home to their husbands. The next day at hockey practice, Siobhan's son Liam got slammed against the boards and suffered a gruesome break in his arm. Carter flew with Liam to Boston, where he was going to be operated on, while Siobhan stayed home with Aiden and cried and worked her way around the rosary beads.
"Surgery," she said. "Jesus, Mary and Joseph, cutting up my baby, putting him under."
Claire went to the grocery store while the kids were at school, with the idea of getting a chicken to roast to take to Siobhan and Aiden, as well as some Oreos and ice cream to cheer them up. The store was quiet and nearly empty. Claire was relieved that she and Siobhan had not misbehaved the other night. Unlike the Crispin brothers, Claire and Siobhan were Irish Catholics, and hence were united in their belief that when you did something bad happened to you. But what if that weren't true? Claire thought, as she wandered down frozen foods in search of Häagen-Dazs. What if things weren't connected? After all, Siobhan had behaved like a saint, and Liam still got hurt. Claire heard a harsh laugh. She looked up, and at the other end of the aisle saw Daphne Dixon.
"Oh, very bad."
Claire could spend hours having conversations in the Stop and Shop with nearly anyone, but Daphne Dixon was someone Claire did her best now to avoid. She wanted to duck behind the tall display of dog food and disappear, but Daphne spotted her. The laugh, which sounded like the cackle of a satanic rock star, seemed to be aimed at Claire.
"Hi," Claire called out.
She waved but made no motion forward. She could get away with this, perhaps, a wave and pivot, and at the expense of Siobhan's ice cream, she was out of there. She did get a gander at Daphne, however, and was surprised to find that she looked fabulous. She'd had her hair colored so that it was very dark, and she wore a white tank top and a quilted jacket and a gold medallion necklace that glinted against her tan breastbone. The first time Claire had ever laid eyes on Daphne Dixon had been 10 years earlier. Claire was pregnant with J.D., and she and Jason were at a pool party. Claire was miserable, first of all because she was wearing a maternity bathing suit the size of a circus tent, and second, because everyone was drinking Coronas and margaritas except for her. Jason, who had never gotten the hang of being a sympathetic partner in pregnancy, was especially drunk. He pointed across the pool at Daphne Dixon, who was wearing a tan bikini that made her look nude, and said,
"That woman has beautiful tits."
She may indeed have had beautiful tits, and Jason may only have been making an innocent observation, as he claimed, But once you heard your husband say that a woman had beautiful tits, you could never give that woman a 100% endorsement. Somehow, though, Daphne had won Claire over. Later, at that same party, Daphne cooed over Claire because she was pregnant. Daphne and Locke had a 5-year-old daughter named Heather, and Daphne confided that she had very much wanted a second child, but she'd suffered complications after Heather was born. When she found out Claire was a glassblower, she went wild. She loved glass. She was a devotee of Dale Chiuli. She would love someday to see Claire's work. Okay, Claire thought. Claire worshipped Chiuli, too. Daphne knew what she was talking about. A year or so later, Daphne and Heather started spending more time on the island. Daphne enrolled Heather in the elementary school, and Locke commuted to Nantucket from Boston on the weekends. Claire saw Daphne every so often, and they chatted about preschools and swim lessons and the commissions Claire was working on. Then Claire got pregnant with Audley, and Daphne again was interested and attentive. She even dropped off a tiny pink sweater at the hospital with a note that said, "As soon as you're ready for a girl's night out, call me." The Daphne Dixon that Claire remembered from those days was extremely normal and good-hearted. She was lovely, really. Claire stopped in the chicken section and threw the biggest roaster she could find into the cart. She was afraid to look behind her. "Claire?" Claire turned very slowly. Daphne was right there, inches from Claire's face. Claire could smell Daphne's perfume and something else. Vinegar. The salad dressing may be from Daphne's lunch. Claire thought it again.
Oh, very bad.
Hi, Claire said. She hadn't seen Daphne Dixon in ages. Her voice should convey more excitement. Instead, it contained false enthusiasm, dread, the old useless guilt, and fear that what was coming was not going to be pleasant. Daphne, how are you?
Fine, Daphne said, in a way that made Claire, like J.D., think, mental patient. I'm fine. Locke told me you're chairing the gala this year.
Yes, Claire said, I am.
You know why they asked you, right? Daphne said. Right.
Right, Claire said, because
they want Max West, Daphne said. But Locke doesn't think you'll be able to deliver.
They'd been talking for 10 seconds, and already Daphne had landed a jab. The most pronounced result of the car accident was that Daphne had lost the filter between the appropriate and the inappropriate. She had lost her ability to finesse social situations, to turn a blind eye, candy coat, lie.
So Locke has a call in to Steven Tyler from Aerosmith. We knew him a little in Boston.
Okay, but I'm pretty sure that,
and the other gal, Isabel French? She's making some calls to people on Broadway. Though, frankly, I think she's pretending to be more connected than she actually is.
I've never met her, Claire said. We have a meeting, though, next week.
I want you to tell me if Isabel French makes any overtures toward my husband. Will you tell me?
Overtures?
If she touches him, or if they spend time alone together, I want you to call me. Between you and me, that woman is a viper. Here. I'm going to give you my card.
Daphne rifled through her purse, which was also quilted. She was wearing jeans and a pair of suede Jack Rogers sandals. She looked great, but this was just plain old deception. Daphne pulled out a business card and handed it to Claire. It was white, with Daphne's name and various phone numbers printed in navy. Claire had never known anyone to have a business card just for herself as a person. It was unusual, right? An affectation of the wealthy? The card should read, Daphne Dixon, crazy person, or Daphne Dixon, mental patient, so that you would know never to dial the numbers. Even if you did see Isabel French grabbing Locke Dixon by the necktie and planting a kiss on his lips.
Okay, Claire said, we'll do. I mean it, Claire, Daphne Dixon said.
She tucked her very dark hair behind one red ear. Why was her ear so red? Agitation? She was standing so close to Claire that Claire could see the delicate purple veins of Daphne's ear.
I want you to call me if you see anything, if you suspect anything. When I say viper, I mean viper.
She kissed another woman's husband in front of everyone on the dance floor of the Waldorf Astoria Ballroom last spring. And it is a well-known fact that Isabel French wants to fuck my husband.
Claire laughed.
She did not find that statement funny at all, but there was no point in further engaging the woman.
Agree.
Yes, Daphne, you bet. I'll let you know. And extricate yourself from the conversation. Get the hell out of there.
You bet, Claire said.
She pushed her cart all the way to the ham, bacon, smoked sausages, pickles, and sauerkraut. She could feel Daphne Dixon behind her, but she was afraid to check. She stopped, feigning interest in sauerkraut, thinking that rather than have Daphne Dixon shadow her through the store, she would let Daphne pass her. She fingered a package of sauerkraut. Claire liked it, but no one else in the house did. And then she studied a jar of kosher dills.
Pickles? Daphne Dixon said.
Claire was so spooked she nearly dropped the jar. Daphne was right up against her back.
You're not pregnant again, are you, Claire?
Again, Claire laughed.
No, she said. You're sure? That was one of the things I said to Locke. The problem with asking you to co-chair is that you're always getting pregnant.
I'm not pregnant.
At least you're having sex, Daphne said, which is more than we can say about yours truly. And if you're having orgasms, then you're really one up on me.
Claire was annoyed to find her interest piqued by these statements. Locke and Daphne didn't sleep together? So did Locke have a thing for Isabel French? Was Claire stepping right into the middle of a messy situation? Friend from college, divorced. What if it had been Isabel at the cozy meeting the week before and not Claire? Would something have happened between them? But Claire had to cut bait here. Daphne was like an unsightly piece of toilet paper that Claire had dragged out of the ladies' room on her high heel.
Do you ever shower? Daphne said.
She sniffed in Claire's general direction, and Claire looked down at her clothes. Yoga pants, ratty sneakers, a white t-shirt that had turned pale gray and had a juice stain on the sleeve that looked like a gunshot wound. She had done some yoga positions that morning. She had attempted the sketch of the chandelier. She had had 20 phone conversations about Liam's arm, what the doctor had said, the impending surgery. But she had not showered. Should she explain to Daphne about Liam, Siobhan, Children's Hospital, the roast chicken? She didn't smell like flowers, certainly, but did she stink? It was true that you couldn't smell yourself. Maybe she did stink. But Daphne stank, too, like vinegar.
I do shower, Claire said, though I haven't yet today. I haven't had a chance. That's the other thing about Locke asking you to chair the gala. Everyone knows you're stretched out like old gum. 4 kids, one of them a baby, and you let your career go down the tubes.
My career didn't go down the tubes, Claire said.
Locke and I love your glass, but now it's gone.
Daphne snapped her fingers.
Dust. Vapor.
She took a deep, dramatic breath.
We need the gala to succeed, Claire. We need someone who can give it a dedicated effort.
Claire felt tears prick her eyelids. And that was the problem now with Daphne. She told you the unadulterated truth about yourself until you cried. She didn't do it to be mean. She simply couldn't help herself. Minutes earlier, Claire had been thinking about how things weren't connected, how there was no tit for tat, no retribution for one's actions visited on one from above. But maybe she was mistaken. This verbal assault right now was one small piece of payback for everything that had happened the night of Daphne's accident. The irreparable damage that had no name was this. Daphne was now rude. And not only rude, but mean. She forgot things easily. She repeated herself 100 times, whole thoughts and ideas as well as individual words. It became a verbal tic, this repetition. It became a stutter. She had remarked to Julie Jackson while her head was still swathed in bandages,
"I can see everything now. Everything is crystal clear."
But that seemed to mean she had complete disregard for the rules of polite society, for small talk, for being thought of as kind and amenable. Instead, she was sharp-tongued and venomous. She was notoriously brutal. Nobody liked Daphne Dixon anymore. She set out to sting people, like a wasp. She was her own doppelganger now, after the accident. She was a bowl of cream gone rancid. It was always Claire who stuck up for her. "She's not that bad, really. When she's on her medication, she's perfectly fine." The guilt, old and useless, was tar in her hair. It was an invisible thread snarled around her heart. Claire had bought the last drink. She had not absolutely insisted that Daphne get into the taxi, and a woman's personality had been forever altered. Daphne was somebody else now, and Claire blamed herself. Here, in the chilly outer ring of the Stop and Shop, Claire was receiving her just desserts. Daphne was holding up a mirror and forcing Claire to look. "How can you chair the gala when you can't even take a shower? When you were careless in the hot shop and put yourself into preterm labor? When you won't face the fact that your baby isn't now and may never be right? How can you give it a dedicated effort?" "My nephew broke his arm playing hockey and was medevaced to Boston," Claire said. "I have to go. I want to make Siobhan some dinner." Daphne's face softened. "Oh, God," she said. "How awful. By all means, go, go. Let me know if there's anything I can do to help." Claire looked at Daphne. Her ears were pink again, like a regular person's ears. She was, at that second, her old self. But that was part of the problem, too, the inconsistency. Daphne bounced like a tennis ball between two frames of mind. Which personality were you going to get? Claire was no dummy. She was being given a pass, and she was going to take it. "Okay, I will," Claire said. "See you later, Daphne." Chapter 3. He asks her. Again. When Claire walked up the stairs of the Elijah Baker house for the second gala meeting, she found Locke Dixon sitting at his desk, much as he had been 2 weeks earlier, minus the sandwich. He was wearing a pink shirt this time and a red paisley tie. The classical station was on, featuring harpsichord music. The office was dark, but for the desk lamp and the blue glow of Locke's computer. Claire checked her watch, confused. It was 8:05. "Where is everybody?" she said. And at the same time, Locke said,
"Didn't you get my message?"
"What message? No."
"The meeting was canceled. Postponed to next week."
"Oh," Claire said. "No, I didn't get it."
"We should have tried your cell phone. I told Gavin that, and he looked around the office for the number, but to no avail. I'm sorry. Adams has the flu, and Isabel couldn't call in tonight, so we bumped the meeting back to next week. I feel bad that you had to come all the way into town for nothing."
For nothing? Well, in a way, it was for nothing. But Claire didn't regret it. She turned to survey the rest of the office. "Is Gavin here?" she said.
"No," Locke said. "He left at 5.
"Oh," Claire said. "Well, you and I could talk over some things." And at the same time, Locke said,
"Would you like a glass of wine?"
"Viognier?" Claire said.
She worried she was pronouncing it wrong, though she had practiced at home in the shower.
"Viognier." "Yes, I'd love some." When Locke returned from the kitchen with the wine, he said,
"Have you given my proposition any thought?"
"Your proposition?" she said, immediately blushing.
"About the auction item," he said. about your triumphant return as an artist.
Oh, she said. She took a deep breath, then sank into the chair opposite his desk. He sat on the edge of his desk, close to her. I wasn't sure if you were serious or not.
Of course I was serious.
$50,000?
Your bubbles sculptures are worth several times that.
Right, but...
He sipped his wine and shook his head. Never mind, then. It was just a thought.
It was a really nice thought, Claire said. I'm flattered that you believe my work might be worthy.
Worthy, Locke said. It's more than worthy.
Hardly anyone on this island knows me as a glassblower, Claire said.
Oh, come on, of course they do.
I mean, they know that's what I do, or did. But practically nobody's seen my work, the vases, yes, but not my real work.
That's a shame, Locke said.
I have a select clientele, Claire said. 5 people. I'm what you call extreme boutique.
You should be as famous as Simon Pierce, Locke said. One good thing about doing the auction would be the exposure.
But that's not what I want, Claire said. I never wanted to be Simon Pierce, mass-produced and all that.
Of course not. You're an artist.
Claire looked at her hands. They had been calloused for so many years, calloused and sore, cut and burned. They were just starting to look like a normal woman's hands, red from the dishwater, streaked with magic marker. But was this a good thing? She didn't know. Talking about working again tore her in half. It had felt wonderful to open the sketchbook, and the image of the pulled taffy chandelier would not leave her alone. But then Claire thought of the kids, especially of Zack. Should she explain to Locke how Zack had weighed 2 pounds 7 ounces when he was born and spent the first 5 weeks of his life on a respirator? How now, at 8 months, he wasn't crawling yet, whereas her other children had been cruising around, holding on to the furniture? Dr. Patel had told her not to worry. Kids develop at different paces, Claire. Claire wanted to see a specialist, but she was terrified of what he would say. She was certain there was something wrong and it was her fault. Her doctor had warned her. I can't do it, she said. Locke looked at her for a long while with an inscrutable expression on his face.
Okay, he said.
Claire felt tears coming on. What was wrong with her? She suddenly felt very sad and sorry for herself. She tried to stop. Crying in front of Locke was embarrassing. At home, it seemed, one of the children was always crying. Claire was the one who plucked the tissues, wiped the noses, kissed the bumps and bruises, scolded the perpetrator. She did not cry, she realized, because there was no one to comfort her. Jason was as emotionally feeble as the children. If he were watching her now, silently weeping, he would be baffled. Locke offered her a handkerchief. Claire blotted her face, thinking how charming it was that there was still a man in the world who carried a handkerchief.
Are you okay? He asked. Did I hit a nerve? I didn't mean to.
No, Claire said. It's okay. Locke handed her her wine. She took a sip and tried to collect herself. Can I ask you a question?
Shoot.
Why do you work here? I mean, you don't have to work, right? Locke gave her another one of his incredible smiles.
Everyone needs something meaningful to do. I sold my business so I could move to the island permanently, but I never meant to stop working. I never meant to have a life where all I did was golf and talk to my stockbroker. That's not me.
No, Claire said. It's really none of my business.
I looked around the island to see where I would be happiest. I looked at buying a real estate development company, but that felt a little empty at this point in my life. There was a woman who cleaned rooms at the hospital when Daphne was there for physical therapy. Her name was Marcella Vallenda. Do you know her?
No, Claire said.
Dominican woman. 4 kids. 3 teenage boys, always in trouble. And a daughter. Husband was a deadbeat alcoholic. He worked some days, and some days he spent at the Muse playing Keno. I got to know Marcella a little bit. She worked 3 jobs. She developed a cocaine habit to stay awake, basically. But the house was a hellhole, and the daughter, Agrippina, found a rat in her cereal bowl.
Oh, God, Claire said.
It happens, Locke said. I had no idea until I met Marcella. But it happens here, just like everywhere else. I wanted to give Marcella money, but money doesn't help. It goes right to drugs. What she needed was programs, and that was how I found Nantucket's children.
I never heard that story before, Claire said.
Well, everybody wonders why I'm here, but few are brave enough to ask. You asked.
Oh, Claire said.
Raising money for Nantucket's children is the most important job I've ever had.
When Claire stood up, her legs wobbled. She was feeling weepy again. Okay, she was hormonal. She hadn't been right since she stopped nursing Zach. But no, it wasn't that, it was something bigger. In her universe, an apocalyptic decision was being made. It wasn't because of Locke's spiel about making a difference, or the rat in a little girl's cereal bowl, at least not completely. Claire was making this decision because she wanted to. She felt like a person she had nearly lost in a crowd. Her old self. I'll do the auction piece, she said.
You will? He said. Are you sure? Now I feel like I goaded you into it.
I'm sure, she said.
She waited, not breathing. Was this moment loaded for him, or was the emotion all in her mind?
She had, after all, just made a monumental decision. Locke was standing before her, larger than life, a god of sorts, a person who could make things happen. I should go, she said.
But wait, he said. There was something in his voice that held her there.
What? She whispered.
Thank you, he said.
He thought she was doing it for him, or for the cause.
But she was doing it, ultimately, for herself.
No, she said. Thank you. When Claire got home, Jason was awake, watching TV with Zach asleep on his chest. Because the whole world was now transformed, Claire looked on them tenderly. Her husband and her baby. They knew nothing about her.
How was the meeting? Jason asked.
Oh, Claire said. Fine, I have to try to find Matthew tomorrow.
He's on tour in Southeast Asia, Jason said. I saw it on Entertainment Tonight.
You did?
Yeah. The Sultan of Brunei attended one of his concerts. It was a pretty big deal. The richest man in the world dancing to This Could Be a Song.
Funny, Claire said. She sat carefully in the chair next to Jason. Listen, there's something I want to talk to you about.
Jason's attention was back on the TV. Deal or no deal.
Jace? I'm serious, I have to talk to you. Jason emitted air that was part sigh, part huff. She was horning in on his date with asinine TV. She had rehearsed a line in the car. Give it to him straight. Skip the cushioning remarks, he didn't want to hear them. But Claire found the raw words hard to say. Jason was glaring at her. He had only muted the TV, he had not turned it off.
What? He said.
I'm going back to work.
Instinctively, it seemed, he squeezed Zach. Right. The guilt was so automatic, Claire's fingers started to tingle.
She had regained consciousness on the med-flight jet with Jason stroking her hair. They don't know about the baby, he had said. They don't know about the baby.
Now, the accusation was loud and clear in Jason's silence. Her work had nearly killed their son. If he had his way, she would never set foot in the hot shop again.
She had overheard him telling Carter that he wanted to dismantle it, bomb it, burn it down.
What? He said.
I'm going back to work. For one project.
Did Chick call?
That was the right question. Chick Clawson had flown to Boston to see Claire in the hospital. He was racked with guilt that Claire had gone down while working on his piece, and Claire was racked with guilt that she had to ask a studio to finish it. She told Jason that she would only return to work for Chick, but both of them knew Chick would never ask. No, she said. Not Chick. I'm going to create a piece for the gala auction.
Jesus, Claire, Jason said.
Locke asked me, she said. He thinks it will bring in a lot of money.
It's too much to ask, Jason said. You're already chairing the damn thing.
I know, Claire said, but I'm ready to go back. I want to get back in there. I miss it. It's who I am.
It's a part of who you are, Jason said.
An important part.
And what about the kids?
They'll be fine. I have Pan to help me. It's not going to take a lot of time.
Sure it is, Jason said. They're not asking you to make cupcakes for a bake sale, Claire. They want an auction piece, something intricate.
What I make is my choice.
He shuddered, jarring the baby. Zach started to cry. Bitterly, Jason said,
Great, you woke him up.
Claire said, I was hoping you would understand. I was hoping you would get it. I'm ready to go back.
Here.
Jason held Zach out to her. Zach clawed the air like an upside-down bug. Jason said,
It hasn't even been a year.
Zach is still a baby, and a baby needs his mother.
You should have said no, not just to the glass, but to all of it, the whole thing, the gala.
Claire took the baby and kissed his forehead. She didn't know how to respond, and it didn't matter. Jason went back to watching TV. There was no predicting how happy the idea of going back to work would make her. Claire was both her old self and a new person. She was more energetic with the kids, solicitous, playful. She kissed JD on the cheek and he freaked out, and Claire laughed merrily and kissed him again and tickled him under the arms until he said, Mom, quit it, with a big grin on his face. She bought a new sketchbook and a set of number two pencils. She sharpened the pencils and stroked the heavy, creamy paper. She then spent 2 hours sketching the pulled taffy chandelier in meticulous detail. It was going to be nearly impossible to execute by hand, on her own, but this galvanized her. Siobhan called just as Claire was ready to take a break. Siobhan said, How's the work going? She had been skeptical when Claire told her the news. She didn't understand why Claire would work if she didn't have to. She didn't understand why Claire was going back to slave over a project that she wouldn't even get paid for.
You're a bloody fool, Clairesy. No boundaries.
Claire said, It feels better than a hot stone massage. Siobhan said,
Oh, come on,
and laughed.
Really? Claire said.
You're soft in the head, Siobhan said.
It felt good to have a mission. Setting the 2 hours aside for work made the rest of her day